This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next Tuesday, Ted Koppel signs off as the anchor of Nightline. He began the show in March 1980, after having already anchored that late-night spot for several months when it was called America Held Hostage and was devoted to coverage of the Iranian hostage crisis. Count me as one of the people really sorry to leave him to see him leave the show. I've often stayed up later than I should to learn about the latest crisis and to learn from and admire how Koppel handled tough interviews. Ted Koppel, welcome back to Fresh Air. So why are you leaving Nightline now? I mean, was it a really difficult decision to make about, like, should I leave? Should I stay? Should I leave right now? Should I put it off another year?
No, because my contract is up in a few days. So this is something I began thinking about really a long time ago. And in fact, my executive producer, who is a very dear and close friend of mine and with whom I will continue working after I leave ABC, he and I went to see our bosses 5 years ago and said, look, it's time to begin preparing for the transition. Frankly, I think 5 years is a long time to transition out, but we've been doing it for 5 years.
I'm going to give you the chance to answer a question that I don't think you're going to answer, which is, what are you going to do next? So here's your chance to make news on our show and tell us first. And then,
God, what a temptation.
I am literally
holding myself back here, Terry, from wanting to blurt it all out. But mm-hmm. I think I have just enough self-discipline left that I won't.
Okay. Within the period of about a year, Tom Brokaw retired. Dan Rather was basically forced out. Peter Jennings died. And now you're leaving Nightline. So everyone is calling this the end of an era. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, you know, it may well be the end of an era. We are all of the same age. Peter was a couple of years older than I. He and I had been friends for 41 years. We used to joke between the two of us we had put in 83 years at ABC. Tom Brokaw and I have known each other a long time. We're born literally 2 days apart. So I think it's reasonable that it's not reasonable that Peter died at such a young age, but I think it's reasonable that as a generation of broadcasters, that we are sort of moving out of one phase and moving into another. And that is not in and of itself a bad thing. There will always be. I mean, I remember when Peter and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw came in as anchors, there was a great deal of tearing of hair and chest thumping and people saying, well, you know, Brokaw is no Jack Chancellor, and, Rather is no Walter Cronkite, and Peter actually was just replacing himself and two other guys who had been on the program, Frank Reynolds and Max Robinson. But the sense at that time was, well, we've come to the end of an era, and we had, and it was the beginning of a new era, and a fairly good one.
Do you think that the networks want to use this as an opportunity to rethink what they want their evening news coverage to look like? And do you have a sense of, if so, do you have a sense of what that might be?
Well, Les Moonves, who controls that part of Viacom which controls CBS, has made it abundantly clear that he thinks it's time to put an end to the Voice of God anchorman image. I'm assuming he was joking, but he has joked that he had seen in some European country a newscast in which an attractive young anchor woman gradually disrobed as she was doing the news. I would like to believe that even if he could do that on American network television, he wouldn't, but I'm not altogether sure. Maybe he would. Do I think that there are forces out there that want to drastically change the way that network news has been in the past? Forget about what I think. The people who are in a position to do it are saying it.
Nightline is getting a new look, and we've seen a preview of that already, because it's going to become a several segment program. I mean, there's already been a couple of nights a week when it's been that. Do you regret the change from a single format show, a single subject show, to a show with several shorter pieces with different subjects?
I don't know. I know that we tried it back in the early 80s. The news division and the network decided they wanted Nightline to go to an hour. I think it was motivated more by the sense that they could sell twice as much advertising in an hour than it was by any sense that it would make a better program. But we tried it. We did it for a little less than a year, and it was a disaster. Now, clearly, I didn't know how to do it. Maybe the new guys do. I think that there are, or certainly there is, an abundance of television programming, news programming out there that has several topics on in each program. We call them magazine shows or evening newscasts. The thing that made Nightline unique for a while is precisely the fact that we only did one subject a night. That certainly doesn't mean that that's the only way of doing it or the only way of being successful. In fact, it may be that the age of doing that is destined to be over now and that they're going to try something new. I'm not about to judge it until I've watched it for about 3 months, and then if I like it, I'll say so, and if I don't, I'll say so.
How did you learn to do the long-form interviews that you've done on Nightline? Is that something that you learned basically on the air? And you know, because I'm thinking that kind of interview is different than the type of interview you would have done as a reporter, knowing that you would just be choosing, you know, quotes from that to use.
I mean, you're right. It's a different discipline. If you can do an hour's interview and then cut out the best 3 minutes, in some respects, that's a lot easier than saying we have 8 minutes for the interview, but that's all you've got is 8 minutes. And when the clock starts, you have 7 minutes and 59 seconds to finish that interview, and whatever you don't get in those 8 minutes, you won't get. I didn't find it that difficult to do. I mean, basically, you can't afford to be as polite as you're being to me right now when I ramble on. You have to, every once in a while, sort of jump in and say, with all due respect, you're not answering my question, and let's take another crack at it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to play, I mean, I've always just really admired your mix of respect for your guests, but unwillingness to settle for evasion or spin. And I'd like to talk with you about that. And I thought we could start by playing a fairly recent interview from September 1st of this year with Michael Brown, who then was the head of FEMA. And this was basically the day that he recognized the problems at the convention center in New Orleans. And you express your amazement that he's been telling reporters that he'd found out earlier that day about the problems at the convention center. And you say to him, don't you guys watch television? Don't you guys listen to the radio? Our reporters have been talking about this for more than just today. And I want to play an excerpt from this interview that you did with Michael Brown.
Mr. Brown, forgive me, because I can't imagine what it must be like to have the burden on my shoulders that you have on yours right now. But here we are, essentially 5 days after the storm hit, and you're talking about what's going to happen in the next couple of days. You guys do war games. You have gamed out what is going to happen. In recent months, after a Force 3 or a Force 4 or a Force 5 hurricane, to say, as the president did, well, we didn't know the dams were going to break, or we didn't know that the levees were going to break, is factually true. Of course, you didn't know it, but you could have assumed it. You could have made preparations for what would happen in the event that you knew it was going to be a Force 5 storm that was going to hit in that region. Why didn't you?
Ted, we had people pre-positioned to move in immediately. And what happened, which is unusual in this disaster, there's two things. First and foremost, the disaster continued long after Hurricane Katrina had moved. Make sure we take care of those people. And I just want to say to the American public that they do need to understand exactly how catastrophic this disaster is. And they do need to know that we're going to have every available resource to do everything that we can. We're going to take care of these victims. We're going to make it right. We're going to make absolutely certain that the devastation that has been reaped upon these people is taken care of and that we get their lives back in order.
Mr. Brown, some of these people are dead. They're beyond your help. Some of these people have died because they needed insulin and they couldn't get it. Some of the people died because they were in hospitals and they couldn't get the assistance that they needed.
That's Ted Koppel on Nightline interviewing Michael Brown, who was then the head of FEMA when this was recorded September 1st of this year. first of all, I want to mention that in that interview, you start with, in the part we heard, you start by saying, forgive me, but. Is that something that you think is helpful in what is going to be a fairly combative interview like this? Kind of expressing your understanding that this is going to hurt, but I'm going to ask you this question.
It wasn't just expressing an understanding that this is going to hurt. It was expressing an understanding that he had at that time a far more difficult job than I. He, after all, has the burden of responsibility here, and it's easy for those of us who just sit on the sidelines and carp about what officials are doing to criticize, because we don't bear that responsibility. So when I say forgive me, and when I followed up by saying, you know, I can't imagine what it must be like to bear that responsibility, I really mean that. Having said that, he does bear the responsibility, and therefore he must be held to account when he doesn't perform his job well. This isn't a question. I mean, when I'm sitting there interviewing someone, and I suspect, Terry, it's the same with you when you're interviewing someone, you don't represent Terry Gross, and I don't represent Ted Koppel. You represent the entire radio audience of your broadcast, and I represent the entire television audience that's watching my broadcast. And they tend to sit there, either watching or listening, as the case may be. And to begin with, I think they identify with the interviewer, with you and with me. And they say, okay, go ahead and do your thing. And if you ask the right questions, they will continue to identify with you. If you become too combative or too rude too quickly, they will lose their sympathy for you, and they will transfer their sympathy to the person being interviewed. So it's always a bit of a balancing act to wait for the right moment to say, you know, I've asked you that question twice now, and it's possible you misunderstood me the first time. I'm pretty sure you got it the second time. So you're dodging my question. You're not giving the answer. Because at that point, I think the audience at home is saying, come on, Terry, get in there. Or come on, Ted, get in there. The guy's not answering your question. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to be doing.
Now, in this interview, that excerpt that we heard, you know, Michael Brown says to you that he hopes that they can help people get their lives back in order. And you say, Mr. Brown, some of these people are dead. And I was just wondering, like, what was going through your mind during that point of, like, how are you going to answer what he just said?
What was going through my mind is that we had just seen, I forget whether it was a piece by John Donvan or Chris Bury, but both of my colleagues were down there in New Orleans at the time, and both of them had done very powerful pieces. I think it was Chris who had done the piece at the convention center, showing bodies lying outside the convention center, showing these people who have been waiting for days for proper food, for toilet facilities, for water, for some kind of assistance to get them out of that place, and not getting it. And here is this man now telling me, well, I just found out about it today. How was that possible?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Koppel, and Tuesday night is his final Nightline broadcast. My next question comes as a viewer and as an interviewer. I'm wondering if your sense of etiquette as an interviewer has changed over the years. When you're interviewing somebody in a position of power who is just evading your answers and not, you know, not giving the information that you feel you want and that you feel your viewers should have. And, you know, I was leafing through the book that you wrote several years ago called Nightline, History in the Making and the Making of Television. And, for instance, you have an interview in there with Evan Meacham, who was the governor of Arizona in 1987 when you recorded this interview with him. And he wasn't answering your questions. And at some point he says to you, we've been spent so much time on this one issue. And then you say to him, you have spent so much time evading. If you just answer the question a little more directly, Governor, then we could have gotten through this in about a minute or two. And then later on, you say to him, if you're not going to answer my question, at least be forthright enough to say, Ted, I'm not going to answer your question. Did you always feel comfortable being that forthright when you felt that somebody had pushed too far in evading?
Yes, for the reasons I explained to you before. It's not just Ted doing the interview any more than it's just like, that it's just Terry doing the interview. You're doing it in behalf of your listeners. I was doing it in behalf of my viewers. They have a right to a straightforward answer to the question. Otherwise, why bother tuning in? If all you want is a press release from the governor's office of Arizona, you can probably write to them and they'll send you one every day.
What do you think is the most respectful way of saying that to someone?
I think there are 100 respectful ways of saying that. And I think you have to become a little bit edgier and a little sharper the more often they evade your question. Sometimes people aren't evading a question. They simply didn't get the question the first time around. And I think you have to make allowances for that. But by the second or third time, it's quite clear that they have decided not to answer you. I frankly think it's a lot easier, and if I were advising people in that business how to deal with folks like me, I'd just say, look, I'm not going to answer that question for reasons that you may or may not understand, but if you do, great. If you don't, too bad.
We're talking about people who are evasive. Can you think of one of the most surprising things you were told that you didn't expect to be told by somebody in office?
I was in Moscow a number of years ago, and the then foreign minister had agreed to an interview, and the president at the time was I believe Boris Yeltsin. I guess it was still Gorbachev. And I went in to do the interview, and before we had actually sat down, the foreign minister was walking me around his office and showing me pictures of his family. And then at one point he turned to me, sort of looking stunned, and said, Gorbachev just fired me. And I said, really? Thinking that this was prelude to his saying, and so you can understand I won't be able to do the interview. And I said, well, let's sit down and start talking. And he said, okay. And we started talking, and he told me all about it. And we got through the first reel of videotape, or the first cassette, and we were about to start on the second cassette, and I said, tell me something, have you informed your counterpart? Have you told Secretary of State, I think it was Jim Baker at the time? And he said, no. Do you think I should? And I said, well, I'm sure he'd like to know about it. So with the cameras rolling, he walked over to his desk, picked up the phone, told his secretary to get Secretary Baker on the phone for him. And clearly woke him up at his ranch in Texas and said, Jim, you're the first one I'm telling this. Well, actually the second, I just told Ted Koppel, but I thought you should know, I've just been fired. And then they had a little conversation, and then we went back to our interview. In some respects, that was sort of the most bizarre.
Is there a Nightline broadcast that you think had the biggest impact?
Hard to say. I think we did a week in South Africa on the subject of apartheid back in the mid-80s that had an extraordinary impact within South Africa. The South African Broadcasting Company had decided that they were going to rebroadcast our programs the next day. And while they did some editing on those programs, nevertheless, what they broadcast made headline news all over South Africa. And I think, apartheid was clearly on the way out, but I think that may have hastened the process just a little bit.
I know you're going to be going on to other projects, and I don't know whether that's going to be daily journalism or weekly or long-form documentaries or some of all of the above. But I imagine there will at least be, maybe I'm wrong, a short period of time in which you're not on the air every week.
That's true.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to take a few months off. That much I can tell you.
That sounds like a really smart idea, I have to say. Is there anything that you think you might actually miss about that more or less daily dose of adrenaline that you've been having everything. For years and years. Yeah.
Oh, everything about it. I mean, it is. Look, I quit smoking a long time ago. I still miss it desperately. And, you know, would light up at the drop of a hat. And I get a similar kind of adrenaline rush from daily broadcasting. Of course I'm going to miss it.
So after your last Nightline broadcast, what do you think you're going to be doing 11:30 or 11:35 weekday nights? Do you think you'll be sleeping or watching the show, watching something else?
No, the good Lord has created TiVo, and there is no reason whatsoever to stay up until 11:30 at night to watch it. I can watch it over breakfast the next morning.
And that's what you'll be doing?
Oh, sure.
Well, Ted Koppel, I'm gonna miss you on Nightline. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for all you've done on Nightline. Thank you.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Terry.
Ted Koppel's final broadcast as the anchor of Nightline is next Tuesday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.